Hello and welcome to the MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast. I am Gary Gramling. He is Andy Benoit. It is our first official Deep Dive show. We had the special after the Thursday night opener, but this is going to be what the show is going forward. And Andy, we have some exciting tweets to this year's show.
Do you want to explain them now, or do we just do this on the fly?
Let me explain them now, because I want people to sort of be giddy with excitement as they listen to the show. So we are going to do the usual. Every week we'll have some sort of lead item about a trend around the league. This year we are actually going to use that space to preview a game. We are going to preview all the headlining games for the upcoming week. We are going to have the mini mailbag. We'll take a couple of your questions, maybe two, three, maybe four each week. And we're going to lightning round, not lightning-ish round, but lightning round, the end of the show, every game we did not touch on earlier in the show. This is, I was just putting together the outline, and I was getting excited, and I'm excited now, and I'll probably remain excited. I won't sleep tonight. I'll be so excited about this show.
I love this time of year because you're learning all the teams' rotations and personnel packages and what the new coaches are doing with the new teams. It's fun. It's fun and taxing to go through all this stuff, but it's, you know what I always wish the NFL would do while I'm thinking of it? The best match, like, we have Saints and Rams this week. I think it's really smart of the league to put some of those better matchups at the front of the season, because we know that that's a big game based on what happened last year. If you save some of those games, those inter-division or out of division or out-of-conference games, if you save them, I think you run a high risk of having somebody not be as good as expected, or an injury or something diminishing the game. All the big games that they can think of, they ought to front load them, because you're going to get naturally big games later in the year with breakout teams that they didn't expect.
Well, and also people have stuff to do later in the year as well. We're all excited about football now, so we are really excited about some of the huge matchups this week. We have a big one with Saints-Rams, obviously, and we'll get to that in a moment. But we're starting, Andy. You mentioned new coaches, new schemes, new places, new quarterbacks, all that stuff. We are starting with the Cardinals and Ravens matchup. This is Arizona at Baltimore on Sunday. And look, we wondered all offseason, what are Kyler and Cliff Kingsbury's Cardinals going to look like? What are the Ravens going to roll out with Lamar Jackson this year? We got some fairly emphatic answers in week one. And previewing this game, we're just going to talk about the two offenses and how they match up with defenses that are certainly better than the opponents they faced a year ago, but a week ago. Let's start with the Cardinals. I will let you sort of go into what the Cardinals did last week against the Lions in the tie there, and then I want to tell you my concern, but I don't want to color this for you, Andy. I want you to go ahead and tell me what you think of that offense.
Well, we saw a lot of four receiver sets, which we kind of knew we would. I don't know if that's going to be as big a deal as you would imagine at first blush, because let's say if the Cardinals, for example, they don't have a lot of tight end weapons on that roster. Let's say if they had an Evan Engram type, or even someone like a Kyle Rudolph, just a very classic tight end, a quality classic starting tight end. I'm not sure that they would do four wide as much as we thought. Maybe they would. I don't know. We don't know about Cliff Kingsbury. So this whole the four receivers versus three receivers, it's not a huge difference, but it does give you more, just a little bit more options for spreading the field. And I think that can maybe help their running game in their case. It's about, it gets into the theory. Do you want to create gaps and add extra blockers in the run game, or just spread out and create space for your running back? And that just gets into philosophy. One thing that was interesting is when they did run the ball, and we probably need to focus the conversation from here on Murray, but when they did run the ball, it was a lot of gap scheme runs, so pull blockers. So they're spread out, and then they do pull blocking, which kind of adds more dimension to the spread running game. I'm still getting a feel for what they are, though, Gary, because we didn't really see the offense come to life until they got into two-minute mode where they were down 18. Then they had to go hurry up, and the playbook gets reduced, and that's when Murray got comfortable against Detroit.
So my problem with this offense was, and correct me if I'm wrong, which I might be, no one was open. They didn't have open receivers. I mean, it was the degree of difficulty for Kyler Murray in this game and the throws he had to make were incredibly high. They just, and I'm not sitting here saying like, oh, I expected to see, Christian Kirk running downfield without any defender within 20 yards of him, but no one was open. It just felt like they were just scraping and clawing for every completion.
Detroit's a physical man-to-man coverage team. The way they teach it in Detroit is to play on the lower hip of the receiver. So you're kind of in almost a tailgating position. Depends on the routes and where you're stationed, of course. But that's kind of their general technique. It's an aggressive matchup approach to coverage. And what concerns you about Arizona, and part of the reason I think no one was open, including especially against a team that plays man like that, mm-hmm. There's not any speed on this offense. There are no vertical weapons to speak of. They've got a lot. I mean, Christian Kirk and Larry Fitzgerald are the same guys. Fitzgerald's a better version of the two by far, of course. Keyshawn Johnson, who's played their X receiver, is a sixth-round rookie. You know, that was the guy lining up on the boundary most of the time. You're not influencing coverages that way. So your point, Gary, is a good one. I don't think they have receivers who can win on their own consistently.
Yeah, I was worried about that. And really, I thought in light of that, I was very much encouraged by Kyler Murray's performance. Obviously, he was much better late in the game than he was early in the game. The one thing that sort of stuck out to me for him, especially early on, was he seemed to have sort of trouble calibrating the speed of NFL defenders when he tries to use his legs. He seemed to be sort of maybe taken by surprise a little bit that he wasn't outrunning linebackers the way he was at the college level.
Absolutely. And I think it's also not just the speed, but the angles of the football field are different in the NFL. Mm-hmm. So the defenders you might read a coverage, but the defenders that you're going to have to get by when you're scrambling, if it's linebackers or whoever it is, when you're changing your launch point, those defenders are going to be in a different location on the NFL field than they are in the college field. Just subtly different enough. Murray did not look at all comfortable outside the pocket, and it looked like it surprised him a little bit. Like a guy who's always been able to just run away from people, he couldn't in that game. So the question then becomes, is he not he's as fast as however fast he measures, but there's playing speed. That's a whole different conversation. In the NFL, is his playing speed what we thought it would be? Or is it just a function of he has to adjust to the surroundings around him? It's all ancillary, mm-hmm. though, because if he's going to succeed, he's going to be a passer first, runner second. And he certainly, even if he looks like he did on Sunday, he certainly has plus mobility, obviously. So it's not like he's immobile or anything. But he's not as twitchy as some of the other mobile. He's not Lamar Jackson, who can really go from 0 to 60 and twitch as he does it.
Well, let's take this opportunity to talk about Lamar Jackson then. Look, the Dolphins are not good at all. Their game plan seemed to be to dare Lamar Jackson to throw the ball to the point where it was almost like they were treating him like a wildcat quarterback at times. A Ronnie Brown back there taking direct snaps and running the wildcat. What did you think of the offensive performance? And I mean, obviously it was very impressive, but do you think this translates fully going forward, translates mostly going forward? What did you like? Should we be a little bit hesitant to say this is going to be something that will work going forward?
Well, we can be hesitant. They're not going to score 59 points a game very often. And Miami had 14 new guys on the team. 14 of their players active for the game had signed with the team that week, which I have never heard of anything like that in my life. And some of those guys were in the secondary, and there were communication issues. And Baltimore, you know, they took advantage. So great out of the gates. Here's what we know about Baltimore, though. They're going to be a run-first team. They're leveraging Lamar's legs in the run game. They didn't have to rely on the legs themselves. He didn't have to run the ball against Miami, and that's the best of all worlds. You don't get less wear and tear on him, but that's the starting place. His legs as a threat, and he probably will be handing it off a lot more than running it, and you still want to use him as a weapon in the run game and make defenses have to respond to him. The other thing is gap scheme or pull blockers, misdirection pieces, a lot of moving pieces in the run game. Two tight end sets is what they're going to be operating out of. They're not deep at wide receiver. And I think their tight ends, Gary, have a chance to be Mark Andrews especially. That's a chance to be a really good tight end duo between he and Hayden Hurst.
Yeah. So when we're looking at this specific matchup, these offenses against these defenses, and we'll start with the Ravens offense versus the Cardinals defense here. It's, you know, a lot of new faces on this Cardinals defense, but you also got a lot of, you have a lot of veteran guys on this defense. I feel like you might not see a worse defensive performance than you saw from Miami last week, but I don't know. What do you think the Cardinals could take away from what they saw from Lamar Jackson last week? I mean, what kind of approach would you take, considering the Dolphins clearly built a game plan based strictly on what they saw 1 year ago from Lamar Jackson?
I think it starts with being disciplined on the edges. And if you can force the running game to take place within the middle of the field, not let anyone get outside of you, that's a big deal. Terrell Suggs, Chandler Jones, I like what I have if I'm Arizona in that sense. Then it's about your linebackers playing and what they can read and react to. And last year I was surprised that Haason Reddick didn't get more reps, Gary, under Steve Wilks. Oh boy, coaching staff, you ought to play him. And if he's not ready, it's your job to get him ready as coaches. Well, it's a new staff now, and Haason Reddick still was rotating in last week. Jordan Hicks, rather, is the every-down linebacker, but Reddick was rotating with Joe Walker, which tells you they might not be completely comfortable at that position. That's not an issue you want to have going into a run game that has as many moving pieces as Baltimore's presents.
And on the other side of it, I would imagine you'd see Kyler's going to see a lot from the Ravens.
Yes.
Ravens probably show you as much as anyone's going to show you. I know how do you feel about that with an offense that, as we saw, there's not a ton of talent in that receiving core.
Well, last week when Murray faced overload pressure, which Detroit does not do often. Detroit is not at all a blitzing defense, but when they did bring it, it was highly effective. Murray did not identify it. He didn't know what he was looking at. He didn't know how to respond. Baltimore's foundation is overload pressure, and they're particularly difficult to deal with early in the season because a lot of their pressure looks that you get are not things that they've shown on film coming into the game. They're a little bit mysterious in how they line up. So that's a big deal. And if I'm Baltimore, I fight fire with fire and try to make Murray react to us, especially if I'm not as I'm sure they respect his legs, but especially if I put on that Lions film and saw, hey, he doesn't necessarily run away from people the way our guy might if we did it in practice. I think they're going to come after him, and they're going to disguise the way they do it. And on the back end, they'll play matchup coverage behind it, and they've got, even with Jimmy Smith out, they're probably a better secondary than Detroit.
The MMQB NFL podcast is brought to you by DraftKings. Week one is in the books, but DraftKings isn't finished celebrating with some huge fantasy football contests. For week two of the football season, DraftKings, the leader in one-day fantasy football, is giving new users a free shot at over $1.5 million in prizes with your first deposit when you put in code MMQB during signup. Draft your lineup and feel the sweat like never before. Every run, throw, and catch mean more with a DraftKings lineup on the line. It's simple. Just draft your lineup, stay under the salary cap, and see how your team stacks up against the competition. Plus, all new and existing users get a deposit bonus up to $500. That's some extra cash to play with this football season. Nothing adds to the sweat of watching the game quite like having a shot at over $1.5 million in prizes. Download the DraftKings app now and use code MMQB. For a limited time, both new and existing users can get a deposit bonus up to $500. New users, don't forget to enter our code MMQB to get a free shot at over $1.5 million in prizes with your first deposit. That's code MMQB only at DraftKings. Minimum $5 deposit required. Deposit bonus requires a 25 times playthrough. Eligibility restrictions apply. See DraftKings.com for details. We're also brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MMQB. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Just a quick note before we move on to the Saints-Rams. I've been talking about it for a while now, the new lineup for the MMQB NFL podcast, the Monday morning podcast. It is, in fact, on Monday morning. We will continue to have the rotating cast of characters coming in there. It was myself and Connor Orr last week. Who will it be this week? We don't know. I mean, literally, we don't know right now. I don't know who it's going to be. Every Tuesday, Albert Breer's mailbag, so be sure to send questions to him via Twitter. Jenny and Connor, did you hear the name for this, Andy? The Weak Side Podcast.
Okay.
So, properly self-deprecating, but not at all true. But Jenny Vertis and Connor Orr every Wednesday rounding up some of the news around the league. Andy and I, we're here right now. It's Thursday, or it's after Thursday that you're listening to this on. We will be in your inbox every Thursday. And Friday, Jonathan Jones, new show. I think I know what he's going to call it, but it's not official yet, so I will not announce it. But he's going to catch up on everything we missed during the week. He is going to talk to a lot of interesting people from around the league about football and more. If you don't already, you have to subscribe to the MMQB NFL podcast. You will regret it deeply. And all the shows are free. Can't go wrong. Saints Rams, Andy. Rematch of the NFC title game of a year ago. But I do want to, I feel like we're going to talk about this pretty much every week when we talk about the Saints. I do want to point to one play in their Monday night victory over the Texans. That's when, Ted Ginn got way behind the Texans secondary when the Saints were trying to put the game away. And Breeze just, he didn't have a lot of juice on the deep ball. You watch that game on Monday night. Do you feel like this is going to be an issue for the Saints going forward, possibly all season here?
Well, another way to look at a quarterback's arm strength are what throws is he attempting? Because halfway through the fourth quarter, as our friend Joe Tessitore pointed out in that game, they had zero passes that have sailed 20 yards or more downfield. We're halfway through the fourth quarter at that point. So Breeze did hit a deep shot when he needed it late in the game as a 4-vertical concept. But I hear what you're saying. And the fact that he's not attempting those throws is probably a little bit revealing. But look, that's the offense. They're set up to play that way. They're more of a possession offense than people realize anyway. They're built around Michael Thomas, a possession receiver through and through, and Alvin Kamara, who's explosive, but he's an underneath weapon. He's not running vertical routes because he doesn't line up on the line of scrimmage. So they're equipped to play that way, and their run game is excellent. That's their formula for this season, and I would feel plenty comfortable with it if I'm New Orleans.
You know, the Rams kind of effectively contained Michael Thomas and Alvin Kamara a year ago in the NFC title game. What did they do, and do you think they go that route again on Sunday?
Well, and Kamara did have some stretches in that game where he took over, but he never owned the title game. He's beaten them before. They've had some issues with him in the past. What they can do, and what I imagine they will do, there's two things. For one, when they play man coverage, and we're still learning what this Rams defense is in 2019, this new iteration of it. They have some new personnel. Eric Weddle left last week's game. I don't know what his availability would be, but you have to figure that out. So it's a to be determined. But what the Rams have historically done with the Saints is play some sort of man coverage with help defenders inside. And man lurk is a great coverage for that, where there's a deep safety and then basically a shallow safety also in the middle of the field. That can help on those in-breakers that Michael Thomas runs. That can help as a spy factor kind of on Alvin Kamara. The other, so that's one idea, is man lurk. The other thing they do is they call it bamming. A lot of people call it bullseye. But somebody, whoever it is, the defensive end, hits Kamara anytime he exits out of the backfield or anytime he's from a wing position. The Rams did this to James White in the Super Bowl as well and had a lot of success with it. And they employed this tactic at times down the stretch in the championship game last year against Kamara, having your defensive ends hit him out of the backfield. You're sacrificing pass rush when you do that. But you're probably not getting, you're not relying on your pass rush when you face Drew Brees anyway. He is too proficient at getting through his reads.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like they got something of a preview last week. Christian McCaffrey obviously had a big game against them. They did win the game, and they weren't, they weren't lit up by that Panthers offense. But you kind of wonder how they're going to deal with Alvin Kamara this week. Let's go on to Texans Jaguars. You know, this Jaguars pass rush has really eaten up. I mean, everyone's eaten up that Texans offensive line the last couple of years, but Jaguars have really gotten them in a couple of games.
Yeah.
You have a revamped Houston offensive line. How is that front five and Deshaun Watson? How are they going to navigate this thing on Sunday?
Yeah, you're right. We have seen games where the Texans have just... There have been times not only have the Texans piled up sacks on top of sacks against Houston, but we've seen Houston just completely abandon their game plan early in games before just to add bodies and pass protection. And that's really unfortunate because you know what you're getting from Jacksonville. It's some sort of cover three, maybe cover four quarters with them. And in their scheme, the cover three and cover fours can look very similar depending on how you line up. But you're getting a match zone element like that or just a landmark zone sometimes. So you ought to have plays dialed up ready to beat exactly that, but you can't do that if you have to worry about helping guys in pass protection. Mm-hmm. We probably all forgot, Gary, a little bit. We got guilty of this. I know I was a little guilty of this. Laremy Tunsil's just one human being. You still have to have four others up there with him, and they have not the rest of the offensive line's the same personnel as a year ago. Their rookies are not out there on the field yet. They're high-drafted guys. Tytus Howard and Max Sharping, they're not ready to play or they're not in the lineup yet. So it's still the same weak offensive line that we saw a year ago, only now it just has a really great left tackle. That means they're sound at two spots, left tackle and center. Nick Martin just got a new contract, but the other three are problem positions.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's kind of like, you know, you remember the old, Adrian Claiborne Hall of Fame game against the Cowboys when you had all the sacks, and it was like, you know, they had Chaz Green at left tackle, and they had two other Hall of Fame guys on that line. Although I can't remember, Zach Martin might have been out for that game. I know he was in and out a little bit that season, but, one glaring weakness is all it took to completely sink the Cowboys line that day. And yeah, you saw a little bit of that Monday night. Tunsil gave up one to Trey Hendrickson, if we're being honest, and we're always being honest. I think Trey Hendrickson might have jumped early on that. I think he might have gotten a little bit of a head start. But Tunsil, there's one play where a couple of pass rushers came at him, and he kind of didn't get either of them, and that led to a sack. But I don't know. It just seems like even if things get a little bit better, this is still a problem going forward.
One thing I did like, the Saints gave a lot of amoeba looks or dodgeball looks, you call it, your guys just kind of moving around a little bit, waiting and seeing. And Watson didn't respond to the first couple pressure looks he got out of that early in the game. He did not respond very well. He did as the game progressed, though. And he stayed tough within the pocket. He got better at understanding his protections, and that means both what will be picked up and where are my potential areas of problem. And he adjusted and played accordingly. I thought Deshaun Watson looked, in some respects, it was his most impressive game in the NFL in some respects. And if he's going to play like that and build on that, then this team's a contending team. We'll see, though. What happened last year was he understood. He came in with a knee, and I don't think he probably wasn't as comfortable with the knee as he was letting people believe from what you kind of hear. Mm-hmm. And we're talking mentally comfortable. He was physically able to play, of course, but he doesn't have that issue now. So he's trusting his knee more than last year. But what happened is he started to realize my offensive line can't protect me. And he anticipated pressure and played a little bit antsy because of that. That's human nature, especially if you're young. We'll see if he does that this year, because I do think their O-line problems are not going to be solved tomorrow.
Yeah, it's and by the way, the Cowboys did have, in that Adrian Claiborne game, they did have Travis Frederick, Zach Martin, and Lyle Collins on the center to right tackle there in that game. So, yeah, it takes a village when you have a reactionary position like the offensive line. Other side of the ball on this one.
Hey, Gary, real quick, I want to note, too,
yeah,
just to also spin it positive, and it's going to be more negative for the Texans, but Jacksonville's pass rush looks very, very intriguing. We know what Yannick Ngakoue is. Calais Campbell's playing defensive tackle now with Josh Allen there, and Josh Allen's the guy that really stood out to me. I was thoroughly impressed with how he looked on film against Kansas City. Lines up on both sides. He's just natural. He's just natural. So that'll be interesting to watch, too. They're not facing an easy Texans edge rush at all this week.
Well, yeah, and it's a Jaguars pass rush that really hit Patrick Mahomes a lot last week.
They did. And that's, by the way, that's an issue Mahomes has that he had last year, and he got away with it. But the conversations we've had about Deshaun Watson, I don't want to be having them about Patrick Mahomes. But at some, you know, if it keeps going this way, he's getting hit a lot. And it's more him than the Chiefs offensive line. When you're such a gifted thrower and you're so quick, you can wait longer on throws. The problem is the defense isn't waiting with you. So you're the pass rush, you're going to have to take some of those hits.
From Mahomes to Watson to Gardner Minshew. You kind of like Gardner Minshew and what you saw from him last week.
Most young QBs, when they come in, they play too fast. They're frenetic. Everything's happening faster than they expect. They make rash decisions. Minshew is almost the exact opposite of that. If anything, he played too slowly. He was eerily calm in the pocket, and his best plays were later progression reads that came downfield. He doesn't have a strong arm. It's accurate, but that's what he is. He's a nice-looking college thrower is what he was, and that's what he's going to be in the NFL. But his pocket poise is tremendous. And if anything, he has to get quicker early in his progressions, which I think we'll see if that can come. They can help him a little bit by how they formation, and now that they're game planning, knowing it's him, they can do stuff to tailor to make him more comfortable, because DeFilippo, their play caller there in Jacksonville, was also getting a feel for his QB as they went along. And you could see that as they got more complex with the play calls and the game unfolded. So now they know, everybody knows what they have now, at least. So I would imagine John DeFilippo will tailor the game to Minshew and at least make it easier for him to read early in the down so that he doesn't have to work as late into the progressions. But I was intrigued in that sense. I don't think he's a world beater, but I was intrigued with how he looked.
What do you think? A little bit of maybe the 2019 version of Nick Mullins?
Mullins, I think, is a much more talented player than Minshew. Mullins has a good enough arm, certainly. But yeah, Mullins has that same pocket poise as well. Minshew, I don't know. There's a different energy to it. I don't know if I could put my... Let's put it this way. If they were fighters as pocket passers, Minshew would be elusive and duck you and move around the ring. Mullins would just get into a slugfest and try to beat you with power. Like Mullins will stand in there and take enormous hits. Minshew will too, I guess, because you run that risk when you're in the pocket. But they just have a different pocket energy to me. They both have what you want, which is that pocket poise.
All right, Andy. Those are the big ones for Sunday. We are going to give you a line or two on the rest of the games in just a moment. But first, we are going to open the mini mailbag. And before I get to the first question, I do want to point out, so Albert Breer has the mailbag on Tuesday, and I just completely butchered it in our promo. Don't tweet at him. Don't send him stuff on Twitter. He don't like that. Send your questions to BreerMailbag@gmail.com, or you can call in and use your voice to speak a question. Call 201-596-4346.
Are people actually doing that? What year is this? Do we have a call-in number at the MMQB?
This is a number you can call. I don't know if it will eventually be heard, but we are claiming it will.
I would love to know who answers our phone when that happens. Where's that call go to?
I've heard some shows do like call-in specials and stuff like that.
Huh. Interesting.
I don't know. I don't know what... do you know what area code 201 is?
I've seen it on my phone recently. Hold on. Yeah, I... This is great podcasting here.
Did you see it when you called in to ask Albert a question?
It's New Jersey. It's New Jersey.
Okay. Okay.
You ought to know that. You live right over there.
Yeah, I don't. I try to avoid folks from New Jersey though.
You're still going to see the phone numbers.
Connor's from New Jersey. He's got a different number though. He's not a 201. Yeah, he said, okay. It all checks out. Google tells me you're right.
Oh, you confirmed it. Well, thanks. Thanks for that.
I did. Let's go to the mini mailbag. First one's coming from Dwayne. What did you think of Oakland's defense on Monday night? Are they greatly improved, or are the Broncos just that bad offensively?
Probably a little bit of both. I thought the Raiders looked really good getting in and out of their zone rotations. There was an activeness and an energy to it, especially on the back end. They're still rotating a lot of personnel. They did that last year partly because they didn't feel they had any good players. They're going to continue to do that because Paul Gunther just believes in that. Paul Gunther, from a playing time standpoint, would make a great peewee coach because he's really big on getting everybody opportunities. Everyone gets in the game. They all deserve it. They practiced hard. That's his philosophy, and it's worked for him for a long time. That's what they're going to keep doing in Oakland. Overachieving there, at some point their pass rush does become a concern, and the lack of a pass rush is really what we're talking about. Do you notice Cleland Farrell, by the way, he's playing defensive tackle and nickel. They're not using him off the edge.
Yeah, yep. I mean, it kind of fits his skill set.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. And the other Clemson guys, Shaq Lawson's been like that too.
Yeah, yep. Next one's from Brad. Would love to hear you guys talk about these reports on the Dolphins. You two have spoken intelligently in the past on the subject of tanking, and I'd like to see how Andy feels after these reports. The reports, of course, that there are multiple players, multiple, I mean in the most literal sense. It could be two, it could be 20, I have no idea. But folks basically are saying they want out of there. They don't want to be a part of this Dolphins team this year. They would rather be traded elsewhere.
I understand that. There's... A notion was floated around the media this week a little bit. And to be fair, I think the notion probably came from some within the locker room. And when we say that, we're probably mean the players' agents, that there's a sense that maybe the Dolphins coaches aren't even game planning the best of their ability as part of the, well, I'm still calling it a rebuilding effort, not a tanking job, but
you're the last one. You're the last holdout.
Remember though, part of rebuilding is tearing down what's already on the land. They're in the tearing it down. This one they donated to the local fire department for the tax write-off, and right now it's still in flames as they practice putting out fires. But I would be shocked. In fact, I don't think I could ever come to believe that any coaching staff would not game plan to the fullest of its ability. Remember, Chad O'Shea at offensive coordinator is brand new. Brian Flores as a head coach, he's running the defense basically. He's brand new. Patrick Graham, I guess, is helping run the defense. But it's a new coaching staff. They can't afford to not game plan to the best of their ability because they're having to develop and learn as well. They're part of the rebuilding effort. Part of rebuilding is cultivating some of the talent that you do have. Because as much as they want to overhaul the roster, 10 to 15 of these guys are still going to be critical pieces or meaningful pieces to the team 5 years from now, 3 years from now. We don't know, but it's not like they're looking for 53 new players. They're looking to just overhaul and start. You still want to learn to win in the process of that.
Yeah, I'm with you on that, Andy. I still insist this is a tank job, but the front office tanks, the coaches and the players do not or typically do not. I really don't believe that Brian Flores intentionally did something suboptimal from a coaching standpoint to lead to that disaster on Sunday. But you saw it a little bit with Freddie Kitchens too. The first time head coach, he's a guy who hasn't called plays for a long time. They had their issues with the Browns and sort of an undisciplined penalty filled performance there and a lot of issues out there. So sometimes your coach just has a bad day. I don't believe for a second that Brian Flores is going out there and trying to lose games or trying to give up points in any way. That's not how it works. The problem is the roster that's been built is just it's not competitive.
It wasn't last week. We'll see. It's still one game in. I know it was a humiliating performance. It's one game in. By the way, you mentioned Freddie Kitchens. I got done watching the Browns film late last night. I don't know if I've seen, from a schematic standpoint, as big an ass-kicking as Tennessee gave Cleveland. And really, it was mostly, I don't want to say it was on Baker Mayfield, but he was lost back there. I mean, he didn't know what he was looking at most of the game, Gary. And it was cover two and cover three, but they were getting to it out of totally different looks again and again, and they were blitzing out of cover two, which is very rare because it's still a four-man rush. You don't see blitzes out of cover two. The Steelers did it a few years ago, but not like this. Not with the diversity and effectiveness that Tennessee was doing it. That Titans defense was outstanding, but the Browns, quite frankly, looked totally overmatched in terms of preparation for that game.
Yeah, I was going to say that's going to be I'm curious to see what's going to happen with that Browns team going forward, but I am very much willing to entertain the possibility that Titans defense is just not only extremely talented, but it just came up with a great game plan and just did a great job on Sunday. And sometimes you do that, and it doesn't help when your already bad offensive line loses a guy to ejection early on, and nobody can block Cameron Wake. No one will ever block Cameron Wake, I think is what we learned on Sunday.
Yeah, Wake played well. Some of that was also in conjunction with the coverages working to his favor, but it was a great defensive performance overall. By the way, this Monday night game, we are guaranteed a negative headline coming out of the game because it's the 0-1 Jets under Gase and the 0-1 Browns, probably the two most wounded fan bases in the NFL over the years, with these offensive coaches that some people are doubting and high-profile second-year QBs. Like, it's a perfect stage for negative reaction no matter what. I hope they tie 10-10. No, I'm not wishing that. I'm kidding around. But I hope they both play very well. But there's no way that the main headline from that game will not be negative. There's no chance.
Yeah. It would have to be like 78-77 final.
Yeah, you're right.
Although in that case, one of the head coaches would get the blame for it.
Yeah, actually, you're right. So instead of hoping to see the carnage, because the carnage is inevitable from the media's coverage, I do hope to see something like what we saw in that Chiefs-Rams Monday night game last year. And I just want to see how creative people in our business can get turning it negative.
Yeah. Oh, people will find a way.
Oh, I know they will.
Next one's coming from, we actually have a two-part question from Jack here. This is more a curiosity. Both of these are kind of curiosities, but Jack asks, I saw Kyler Murray is using a visor while visors are common. I was wondering if a tinted visor on a quarterback is advantageous given how defensive backs read the QB's eyes to determine where the ball will be thrown. I do want to point out they are allowing the tinted visors this year. Jonathan Jones had written about this a couple weeks ago. They are allowing them this year for the first time in I don't know how long, as long as you have a medical exemption, I believe it is.
And you need that medical exemption because it's an advantage to have the visor. So the answer to his question is yes, it is an advantage. It's an advantage probably for any position. Although defenses probably read the quarterback's helmet as much as they read his eyes. When you're studying film, you're reading his helmet. You can't see his eyes on film. So it's probably not quite as big a deal as we would guess. The other thing is we make a big deal about eyes. Like, oh, well, we're doing a drop back, slow motion, full screen replay. Just look at Tom Brady's eyes as he looks downfield. Well, everybody's eyes are looking at what they're looking at. I think the whole eyes thing gets a little bit overplayed. Eyes always look more important and more profound on a QB than they actually are. But it is a little bit of an advantage, absolutely.
There was a really neat shot a couple years in the Sunday night game between the Bucks and the Cowboys where they had Jameis Winston and his helmet was pointed towards like the boundary receiver on the right. But when you watch the replay, they had a really clear shot of his eyes never came off the inside receiver on the left. So he was kind of doing the, I guess it's not a full no look, but the the just looking at the side of his eyes at the guy going up the slot. It was neat.
Which tells you that he knows the defense often are reading the helmet. The safeties are 25 yards back, and there's other things coming in front of them. They're not looking at the quarterback's exact eyeballs. So it's a good question. And that ability to move your helmet, your eyes and your helmet usually move in conjunction unless you're really gifted. That's a big part of quarterbacking. That's nuanced QBing.
And Jack's second question here, while some football players have aged better than others, I think we can agree that Gary makes even Tom Brady look like a troll. The man is aging like fine wine. How does he do it?
Yeah, and I'm Jack glad you didn't asked, write that Jack. In. Jack didn't. That's not from him.
He absolutely wrote that in. And I do want to point out, Andy, you are so aggressive to point out my advanced age every chance you get on social media.
Well, you're 40. Yeah, you're 40 years old. And when I Google you, I'm Googling you now. I've Googled you a lot. It types itself in practically on my computer. And I go images. They're young. The first one is it's Amazon.com. It's a young image of you. Very young image. And did you know you have one of those you come up as like author. There's a picture of you on the right of the Google search. And it just says Gary Gramling, author.
Yeah. No, I've done a lot of books over the years for SI Kids.
Yeah. I ought to say children's author then, don't you think?
No, because those books can be enjoyed by someone of any age. That's what a lot of parents and grandparents have found when they have purchased the football fan book, Andy.
Yeah, I got this fan book for my kid, didn't read it, but I didn't want it to go to waste, so I flipped through. No, you and I worked on one together a few years ago, didn't we?
You did. I asked you to vet a couple of sections, which you so kindly did.
I enjoyed that. And then we argued over who got to keep the money. You remember that? But we were both saying, well, you get it. No, you get it. And we mailed checks back and forth for several weeks.
That's the way it goes in the book industry. They said, we're only writing one check, so only one of you can get it. That's pretty good. But yeah, I just feel like you're really anticipating my, my imminent death one day. And you're to point it out.
They'll say, oh, it's tragic. He was so young. And then I'll stand up and say, well, he wasn't that young.
He'll be like, he was 42. He was playing Pokemon Go in a crosswalk and got hit by a city bus. Oh, that'll be a good eulogy, though. Let's go to the lightning round. We're going to do this every week. We are going to hit on every game we didn't talk about yet on this show. And Andy, it is not the lightning-ish round. It is the lightning round. We are going to do these quick. No follow-ups. Are you ready?
Yes. I don't think we can get through it, by the way, with the no follow-ups. And an aside from Gary or me, anyone, but it's going to be Gary, an aside counts as a follow-up. What happens when we get to the Buffalo game? Let's see.
I know. That's going to turn into a 20-minute lecture. But no, I will do my best. If you say something outrageous, I might have to, but I will do my best to hold my tongue here. All right, let's get it going. Starting with Eagles-Falcons, the Sunday nighter. The stat line was obvious last week, but what is DeSean Jackson doing for this Eagles offense going forward?
Well, the vertical dimension. The Eagles were not a fast receiving core last year, really the last couple years. Alshon Jeffrey's he's a vertical weapon because he's big and can win on jump balls, but he's not going to run by you downfield. Jackson gives you that dimension to run by you, and when you are a team built on route combinations, that's a big deal because that loosens the safety and opens up the rest of those route combinations.
Bears-Broncos. Nagy versus Fangio, Trubisky versus basically a slightly less talented version of the D he faced all year in practice a year ago. Which side gets the bigger edge there?
I think that goes to the Broncos. Talking to coaches who have worked with Fangio and then gone on to play him, Fangio remembers what you do. He's got a book on you, and he has a book on Mitchell Trubisky. I would imagine that's an advantage for the Broncos, although they are coming off a very bad performance. They're at home in this one, too, though.
Yeah. Packers-Vikings, will Green Bay have to abandon their new-look offense like they did a week ago in Chicago, where they just sort of it didn't look like a LaFleur offense?
Maybe. I mean, Minnesota's not an easy team to run against. Girthy defensive line, gap sound, aggressive safeties in the run fronts. They come down and play the run as part of the designs in their split safety foundational looks. So I would say that's a possibility. It's certainly not what you want if you're Green Bay.
Cowboys, Redskins. A week ago, Case Keenum got a lot of deep shots on the Eagles. You saw it in the first half. He had another one in the second half where he just overthrew Terry McLaurin on what would have been another long touchdown. Can he get that against Dallas the way he did in Philly last week?
Dallas's corners are a little better. I need to study Philly's corners this year a little closer so far. But Dallas's corners are more talented than Philly's corners. Dallas's safeties also aren't quite as aggressive. So without, and I haven't seen that Redskins Eagles film yet, Gary. It's week one goes like that. I'll see it this weekend. But I just stylistically, I think Dallas is probably a little bit of a more challenging secondary to exploit like that.
Patriots Dolphins, is this the biggest mismatch you've ever seen? And
you know, I was gonna look up what do we know what the biggest Vegas spread is? I just broke the lightning flow.
I know. It definitely wouldn't be this one because this is in Miami, and because the Patriots have not won in Miami since the Obama administration. If this was in Foxborough, it might be a bigger spread here. But I can't remember.
I thought I knew it. I was correct on it. It was. I remember this because I talked to Peter King about doing something before the game. Jacksonville in 2013. Was awful, and they went into Denver, and they were 26.5-point underdogs.
Whoa. I was going to say, I couldn't remember a 20-plus-point underdog in the NFL.
It was that one. And then, and actually, Jacksonville was a 19.5 underdog to the Seahawks later that year.
Oh, my God.
That Holy Jaguars God. Played well in that game, too. I was surprised. I mean, they still lost, but, you know, Broncos beat them. But usually when it's that big a spread, it doesn't go that way in the NFL, which is one of the many reasons pros better than college, by the way, is the blowouts don't always become blowouts. It's a competitive league. I don't think it'll be as bad as we would guess because Miami, they do have familiarity with how the Patriots do things, that Dolphins staff does, and we've seen that mean something before. And I don't know, for whatever this is worth, New England has not played well in Miami over the years. I remember going back in high school, there was not that this means anything at all, but it's fun for me now. I've really broken the lightning deal. but there was a game, a Monday night game, a year that New England went 14-2, I want to say. The Dolphins wore orange jerseys, and they beat them in that game, and Miami wasn't anything back then either. I don't know what it is about South Florida.
Chiefs Raiders. Gardner Minshew looked good against his Chiefs D last week. Can Derek Carr and the Raiders put up 30 plus points and hang around in this one?
I'm not ready to go quite that far yet. I was happy for Oakland and the way they played. Carr looked the best that I've seen him in a while. Maybe year two in Gruden's a big deal. Maybe they're all kind of coming together because of what they just went through this training camp. Kansas City does not have a great defense yet either. I'm eager to see how this one plays out, Gary, but it's not a better pass rush. Oakland will probably be getting the ball out quickly just like they did against Denver because Kansas City does present some trouble on the edges.
Chargers Lions. Can the Chargers for a second straight week find success with a shoddy O-line? They have no Russell Okung. It's shaky on the left side, but they made it work against the Colts.
If they're willing to throw the ball a lot, they can. Detroit's a hard defensive line to run against. Detroit's pass rush it's all contingent on scheme and coverage, which means they got a bunch of slow pass rushers.
Seahawks Steelers. Do the Seahawks have the schematic versatility to take away Juju Smith-Schuster if he's moved around the formation, kind of like what the Patriots did Sunday night?
No, not really. New England's a man-based defense that's very flexible to a receiver that moves around. Seattle plays more man-to-man than people think, but their foundation is still that cover three. They're a diverse defense overall. I don't think they'll be as malleable in that sense as New England was. And also, Seattle's corners are nowhere near New England's corners either. So who would you even want to have? You'd have to be doubling Smith-Schuster, and that can get more complicated when he's moving around because now you have two guys that have to adjust.
Colts-Titans, how will Jacoby Brissett deal with a defense that just baffled Baker Mayfield?
They need to start with the running game because that Titans defense is at its most dangerous when it has two safeties back deep. Whether it's it's when it's after the snap. They don't show two safeties deep, but they rotate to that. If you're willing to run the ball, and they ran the ball very effectively last week in Indianapolis, then your opponent's going to be a little bit hesitant to roll both safeties back after a while.
49ers, Bengals. Bengals had success against that Seahawks D last week. Can they replicate it against a Robert Saleh Seahawks-style 49ers defense?
I think the Niners are more talented than the Seahawks right now on defense because of the difference. And it's really the front seven, and actually we're talking the front four. Seattle's linebackers are very good. San Fran's linebackers looked great. Quan Alexander, before he got himself tossed out of the game for the illegal hit, he was outstanding for the Niners against Tampa. But it's that D-line for San Fran. You're seeing Bosa and why he got drafted number two overall. He looks like a thicker, stronger Joey Bosa almost. That's just style. We're not saying he's going to be that. But the talent's there. And D Ford, you know, that's a good pass rush that they have in San Francisco, at least on the edges.
Bills, Giants. If you're the Bills and you're so good at limiting big plays, do you have to adjust anything against an opponent who just really can't get big plays?
Well, you have to contain Saquon Barkley. That's where the big plays will come from, right? I mean, you got to stop him. That's a good game plan. Probably loading the box, or what do you do when he detaches to the formation as a receiver? What do you do in the passing game? What's your answer for that? Matt Milano at linebacker and Tremaine Edmonds, those guys can both run. And I would imagine they're going to work in conjunction to take Barkley. You don't have to put one guy on Barkley, especially if you're a zone D like the Bills primarily are. So it's going to be a group effort, but the starting place is we're not going to let Saquon Barkley beat us.
And Monday night, are the Jets going to get the ball downfield against this Browns defense after that really dink and dunk heavy performance against Buffalo?
Possibly. The Browns pass rush has some juice as well. Olivier Vernon and Myles Garrett, they're kind of flipping sides back and forth. I was eager to see who would play where. Looks like Garrett's going to wind up being the right defensive end most of the time. Vernon left defensive end. And then inside it's Sheldon Richardson and Larry Ogunjobi. The Browns, I think, can be better rushing the passer than they appeared to be last week. It's a more talented pass rush this year.
All right. That's a wrap for the lightning round. Andy did blow it a little bit, but I think we recovered nicely.
I am satisfied with that. And you got through the Bills okay, too. I commend you.
I did. Once we end the show, I'm going to talk to you about the Bills for an hour or so. But that's going to be a wrap for right now. The MMQB NFL Deep Dive Podcast is Andy Benoit and me, Gary Gramling. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Bravick is executive director of the MMQB. Research help from Reed Foster and Ryan Taylor. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by listening and subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free wherever you listen to podcasts, including themmqb.com, si.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, radio.com/10things, Stitcher, TuneIn, and other podcast providers.